then. Like 25 minutes after 5 or something like that. Nah, I'm kidding. Still a little slightly late start here, though, for a 90.3 WHBC time for American Hit Radio. I'm Tom Ryan, my lovely wife, co-host Heidi Morales. Ryan here as well. Friday, how music changed. We shift things around a little bit. We started a new series just a couple of weeks ago dedicated to one of the most interesting rock and roll bands of all time, I think, a band called The Who. We covered their very, very early years for the previous two shows. And now, show three, we get to cover their first album. Because it's 1965, that's what we're up to now, the end of 1965. As the year draws to a close, things really start to come together for The Who. They have two hit singles under their belt already, and their notoriety was bringing a significant amount of attention to their live performances as well. Townsend, his adoption of the auto-destructive art movement sort of coincided with his adoption of Britain's mod culture, and this combination led to a very distinct image for the band. If you recall, last week we were talking about how Townsend was going to art school and he was learning about the auto-destructive movement, but he literally smashed his first guitar completely by accident when he shoved it up into the ceiling.
True.
And the whole thing didn't come back out. And then he decided he would totally destroy it. Now, obviously, the band got a reputation for doing that, and they ended up wrecking more equipment. It was a very expensive thing to do, but it definitely did help with their reputations. And also, have that coinciding with the fact that that the band had decided to adopt a relationship with the mods because of their relationship with their first manager, Pete Meaden. And both of these things are coming together. Now, not everyone, though, in the band was on board for all of this, though. I mean, most of the
band... Roger Daltrey.
Right, especially Roger Daltrey, was still skeptical about Townsend's songwriting. He felt that Pete was diluting the strength of the band's R&B credibility. Now, that would explain why the band's first album mixes some of Townsend's great hit singles with a handful of R&B numbers that now sound almost embarrassing, especially next to these great songs written by Pete Townsend. History would obviously prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that Pete Townsend saved the band by providing him with something that was uniquely their own. This pretty much marks the real beginning of the band. So with this show, we're going to start featuring tracks from the band's first album. The hit singles, by the way, up until this point, if you don't recall, the first one was I Can't Explain. The next hit up was Anyway, Anyhow, Anywhere. And Daltrey still wasn't convinced. For the next single, he really wanted to do an R&B cover. And the band was doing a song called Shout and Shimmy Live. It went over really well. It was something that they had picked up from James Brown. There's a lot of stuff. Daltrey was obviously, I think that he fancied himself to being a British version of James Brown. So this is the track, Shout and Shimmy, that Daltrey wanted to have released as a single. Here it is, Shout and Shimmy on 90.3 WHBC.
Do you feel all right?
Yeah, yeah. We feel all right.
Well, do you feel all right, children?
Yeah, give me some more of that thing.
You feel all right?
Give me some more,
You know you make me want to shout,
Jimmy.
Shout,
Jimmy,
oh yeah, and then I'll shout,
if that was going to be the band's third single, it would have been wrong on so many levels.
I think someone had this on continuous.
Yes, I can see they did. If that was released as the band's third single, it would just would have been wrong on so many different levels. The first two songs established an image, and that song would have basically changed it. And that, it would have been derivative on about four levels. It's the song itself is derivative because it sounds almost exactly like the Isley Brothers Shout. So even when James Brown did it, it didn't really make all that much sense. And then Roger Daltrey's doing a version of the version that James Brown did, but he's not doing it as good as James Brown did it. He sounds like he's straining to try to imitate something that he isn't. So it all just really wouldn't have worked. I could see that they were
Let's
doing this
Roger
stuff
Let's say Roger was very naive at this point of their career.
Well, at this point in their career, I totally can defend him in another way, saying, look, this is what we know. This is what we do. This is why people come to see us play live. And all of a sudden, you know, they don't know these songs that Pete's writing. They're not coming to hear those songs. So we ought to be doing what the audience wants us to do. That's what's going to sell. But in the meantime, Townsend did release two songs that became hits.
Right. So what's not to believe in?
So, like, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of evidence to say, you know, you got to follow that yellow brick road. You know, that's the one that's going to take you somewhere. So Townsend had a third song for a single in his head. And it was suggested that this would be the next single. Here's what he writes about it. The essence of the song, My Generation, had probably been contained in the first abandoned lyric for I Can't Explain. That first version was a kind of talking blues. The title came from Generations, the collected plays of David Mercer, a dramatist who had impressed me at Ealing, his art college. Mercer was a socialist, verging on Marxist, and his rallying on behalf of his play's working-class anti-heroes later offered me a way to connect with the West London fans of the band. So Pete wrote this song and recorded, you know, he had a little tape recorder that he made his home demos on. This is very rare. The only way you can get a copy of this demo that I'm aware of is if you can get an old copy of the book called Maximum R&B, The Who, which is about 25 years old. It was a little flexi disc that came with that. I digitized it. Here is Pete Townsend's demo for My Generation.
Talking about my generation. I hope I die.
interesting. The manager of the band, well, there were two Stamps, Kit Lambert and Chris Stamp. But Chris Stamp in particular remembers the fight about what the next single was going to be. This is Chris Stamp's words. Pete wanted to record his stuff, of course, but he couldn't push it. So it was down to me and Kit. The only block, basically, was Roger. We might get a bit of blocking from Entwistle, or he might get Entwistle on his side, or Mooney on his side. But really, it was basically Roger. The group was moving out of Roger's grasp, and he wanted to do this heavy R&B thing so that songs like I Can't Explain, My Generation, were like pop to him. He wanted to do the James Brown stuff and all, but My Generation was a heavy block. It really took a lot of persuading to actually get it going. Now, we heard Pete's demo there, one of it. He basically says that he recorded three versions of it, and they were all significantly different from one another. Basically, he says, you know, I was surprised at Chris Stamp's initial interest in My Generation. It was so lightweight. Kit couldn't understand what he was talking about either and asked me to do another demo of it. He said, make it sound better. It became a political and sociological song. Pete's Bob Dylan political poem and Mose Allison Young Man Blues sort of a copy. It was Britain's most serious and subversive song. Bob Dylan had showed that popular songs could be an excellent vehicle for serious subjects. The Who turned the Jimmy Reed like My Generation into this spittingly caustic anthem of youth with lines like Hope I Die Before I Get Old. It was well-balanced, not too preachy or too arty. It was the stuttering statements of a piled-up mod telling the older generation to screw off because they were a drag and didn't know what was going on. I knew immediately that we started doing that thing that it was going to be number one record, explains Shel Talmy, the record's producer. It was one of those things that sounded like a natural to me. We were all sky high by the time we finished because it had everything. And it initially got banned by the BBC because Daltrey was doing his stammering bit. Now, as you hear on the demo, when Pete sang it, he hesitated on the pauses. He wasn't stuttering. But Roger was like, again, like not too keen on doing it, not really familiar with the phrasing. Pete is not singing at all. The only time that Pete's singing is on his own demos.
Mm-hmm.
The public is not hearing Pete sing. So Roger had to basically pull it together. Anyway, you know what ended up happening. Here is the band's third single on 90.3.
People try to put us to down.
Talking about My Generation.
Just because we get around.
Talking about My Generation.
Things they do look awful.
Talking about My Generation.
Before I get old.
Talking about my generation.
It's like my generation, baby. Why don't you all fade away? Don't try and dig what we all say. I'm not trying to cause a big sensation. I'm just talking about my generation. What we all
say.
I'm trying to cause a big sensation. Just talking about my generation. Cause we get around.
Talking about my generation.
Things they do look awful. before I get old.
So there, between the first track and My Generation, as we just played, is the band's third single. My Generation made it to the A side, despite Roger's objections. Shoutin' Shimmy was on the B side of the single. Nobody remembers Shoutin' Shimmy. My Generation became another song that basically, now you've got this incredible, basically a triad of fabulous singles that the band put out. Noisy, Loud, Feedback, Crazy Drums. It sounds like the band's wrecking their instruments as the song ends. It was brilliant in terms of propaganda.
It was foretelling.
Yeah. Released late in 1965. It was so successful in Great Britain that the album came out, and the album took the name of the single. It was called My Generation. Eventually released here in America too, called The Who Sings My Generation. Not that much different. The albums are virtually identical. They swapped out one song. They removed one of Roger's James Brown covers in America and put on a better track. So I guess in a sense, the American version of the album is a little bit better, but they're very, very similar. Like I said, there's only one track difference between the two. So the first album comes out. It doesn't sell at all here in America. It doesn't even chart, if you can imagine that. But it was a huge hit in America. So let's get to the album. Let's play a couple of tracks, starting again with a little bit of a back-to-back of Pete versus Roger. The first track is written by Pete Townsend, sounding very much like already like he's repeating himself a little bit. If you listen to it, you're going to hear it and you're going to say, ooh, this really sounds like one of his hits that he's already recorded. And that'll be followed with Roger doing a cover of a James Brown song. First track is called Out in the Street, and we'll follow that with I Don't Mind, the James Brown tune on 90.3 WHPC.
Out! Out in the street! Listen to me, I'm telling you. You look at me, woman, yeah, and tell the truth. I know you're mine, I can't see that you're in need. I'll show you, woman, yeah, that you belong to me. You're gonna know me, know, know me, know, know me, know, yeah. I'm gonna know you. Give me no reasons, set you go free.
I'm gonna know you.
Relatively inauspicious beginning for a group that is so radically original on their singles.
Yes.
I say that because Out in the Street has an opening and a closing that is very suggestive of their second single, Anyway, Anyhow, Anywhere, with that anthemic strum thing. And then it follows up with Roger doing that rather ordinary James Brown cover. So at first, you know, basically the first impression on the first listen of this album back then might have been something like, uh-oh, I wonder what's going to be happening. Now, as soon as the album was released, the group themselves started to publicly, you know, squabbling over it. Pete said that he didn't like it because the drumming drowned out Roger's voice. Roger said that he liked the album, but that he didn't like the group's singles. Interviewed at the Ready Steady Go Studios for NME, Keith Moon was asked whether the reports that there were arguments and fights within the group were true. Yes, he said, Keith with his wide-eyed and innocent look. He goes, it's Roger. He hates me. Well, why? Asked the NME reporter. He goes, because I told him he can't sing. I don't like half of our records, and Roger is the reason.
Wow.
Keith went on to explain. It's not true to say we don't like the LP. There are some old tracks which we didn't want released. But Pete has written some great songs for the album that I particularly do like. The Good's Gone and La 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 Lies. Some of the old tracks are disgusting, though. Here's two of the tracks that Keith personally said that he did like from the album. We'll hear The Good's Gone and then La 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 Lies, 90.3 WHPC.
Yeah.
this girl with eyes like gems and reactions to your lies, lies, la 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 lies. You can't repeat what you put round, all the things that made me cry. You kicked me when I was down, and they hurt me, all those lies, lies, la 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 la.
You can kind of hear why Keith Moon would pick them. If you know that Keith, think of Keith now as a guy who's a big fan of the Beach Boys and surf music. And those songs, probably the ones, especially La La La, is closest to that sort of an aesthetic, you know? That song, by the way, was also released as a single, although it was the fourth single released from the album. So usually when you take that many tracks off of an album, they stop selling particularly well. The album itself was selling quite well, so there was no need to be buying the single, because La 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 Lies was the A side, and the track before that, The Good's Gone, was the song that was on the B side of that song. So that would make it the band's seventh single, but released well after the album had already been out. So one more track left to play on side one of the album. Because the side ends with My Generation, but of course we played that earlier, basically to coincide with the fact that the single was released before the album. The track that I'm going to play now is strange because I don't really know much about its lineage. In some places it's credited to Pete Townshend, but on the album itself, I'm looking at the British album from 1965, and the song is listed, and it plainly says that it's written by somebody called Pavey Dunican. I don't know who that is. I often wonder if it could be made up. But nevertheless, here is that track from the album, My Generation.
Much too, much too bad. Your love is hard and fast. Your love will always last. If it's you I need, I've got to pay the levy. Got to pay, cause your love's too heavy on me. And it's much too, much too bad. If I ever leave you, darling, I hope you see. Your love's too heavy on me, and it's much too bad. When I make love to you, do all things you want me to do. Think of me, always cry, baby, baby of tears, cause your love's too heavy.
give all I had to you. But my enthusiasm waned and I can't bear the pain.
Song very much in the style that you would think that Roger would have been favoring at around this time, like the harder R&B edge. So I don't know who the songwriters are, but that would explain that song. Now, the other thing that The Who were taking on at this time, besides the mod thing and besides the Yodo Destruct thing, they became a pop art band. This is Pete had a jacket made up for him out of the Union Jack that eventually he stopped wearing, and eventually it was picked up by John wore it for a while. In fact, John is pictured wearing it on the album cover for My Generation. It's very controversial, you could imagine, at the time, if all of a sudden suddenly your flag is being turned into a sport jacket. Eventually it was stolen soon after the shot was taken for the album cover. Well, somebody else had it for a while. But I mention this now because the band's single after this album came out, the third single from the album, is a song that is still to this day very much in the Who lexicon, probably because it sounds like it was written just tailor-made, no pun intended with the jacket, but tailor-made for the mods. It was just something about, you know, Townsend was very much about his generation. In fact, this is interesting. He was even talking about why he wrote the song My Generation. He says, Belgravia, or Belgravia, whatever, a rich neighborhood where women in fur coats shoved me out of line as if I didn't exist, only made more starkly apparent the generational divide that I was trying to describe. I worked on My Generation all through the summer while touring in Holland and Scandinavia. I produced several sets of lyrics and very different demos. The feeling that began to settle in me was not so much resentment toward those establishment types all around my flat, as much as it was fear that their disease might become contagious.
Oh, no.
So, in this instance, rather than complain about other generations, he decides to praise his own with this really awesome single called The Kids Are All Right.
I don't mind other guys dancing with my girl. That's fine, I know them all pretty well, but I know sometimes I must get out in the light. Better leave her behind with the kids are all right. The kids are all right. Sometimes I feel like
you're all right.
Again, you can feel the war, the tug of war going on there between Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend. Townsend supplying the song The Kids Are All Right, literally an anthem for the mod movement, so to speak, in a way. Actually, we were just talking about this. A caller called in to basically, we were talking about the words. And I guess it could be interpreted in a lot of different ways, but I hear it as Townsend taking on the personality of Mod Kid. He's basically all pilled up, speeding, has a girlfriend, but probably because of the fact that he's speeding, it doesn't have a very good relationship with her and feels that he's going to lose her. But he is like rationalizing it in his head, saying, I'm okay with that because I can still hang out with my friends.
Right.
Because the kids are all right. That sort of thing. To me, that's how I hear the words.
Right. It's okay if she dances with another guy.
Right. You know, right. Exactly. Because the kids are all right. So there's it's very interpretable, but that's just one way of looking at it. And this is exactly why Roger was kind of hating what Pete's doing. He feels that Pete's writing these pop songs about teenagers, and Roger wants to write this grown-up American R&B, sing American R&B. Roger's trying to be James Brown, as you can tell. There he is. Singing Please, 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 which... I mean, I get why Roger would like it, but if you were to play the Who's version of Please, Please, Please after playing James Brown's version...
Oh, it's just watered down.
You'd probably chuckle. Like, ooh, that's not very good, Roger.
Nobody wants water in their chocolate milk.
There you go. So, I mean, so that was like more or less the fight that was going on with the band. But it's quite obvious, as we said earlier, that Pete... In history, Pete won that battle in history.
But I guess Roger was also feeling that Pete was channeling a little bit too much of the Kinks.
I'm glad you brought that up.
The music.
because if you look at the first four singles, I can't explain anyway, anyhow, anywhere. Maybe not my generation, but then, you know, the kids are all right. Throw that into the mix. These are songs that are so, like, I don't want to say...
you can hear the licks in there.
Yeah. I want to say derivative of Ray Davies, but Pete himself said that he got so much of his inspiration from Ray Davies, and Roger was actually pointing it out to Pete, saying, you know, I don't want to do your stupid songs that are ripping off, you know, the Kinks.
Your Kinks rip off songs, but,
you know,
man.
That was the argument. Because, you know, I don't, you know, you're ripping off a pop band. It's not even original. So which would get Pete angry, I'm sure.
I'm sure.
But, you know, Pete also had to admit that, you know, he even said that when he was writing the songs, he would play some of the Kinks tracks over and over and over again for ideas and inspiration for writing his own songs. Because not even like I had to, because I knew those Kinks songs so well, I had them memorized by heart.
Of course, they were on the radio. They were ubiquitous.
So, you know, that is what was causing that to happen. Now, meanwhile, let's see, in late 65, during their first European tour, the arguing among the group members became so bad that on their return, the group broke up. Roger and Keith never got on in those days. And in the interval between two shows one night in Denmark, Roger knocked Keith out.
Ouch.
Keith, Pete, and John had been taking pills throughout the whole tour, but Roger hadn't. I couldn't do speed because I couldn't sing when I did it. Sometimes after we'd finished a gig, I might take some blues and stuff with the rest of them. But if we were gigging, I couldn't because it would affect my voice, Roger explained later. According to Pete, Keith got obnoxious when Roger started having a go at him about taking pills. Pete says, I'm sure we were behaving really peculiarly. You know what people were like in pills. Roger remembers, the band was playing terrible. I had a big flare-up with Mooney in the dressing room. And in the flare-up, I got a hold of his box of pills, and I dropped them down into the loo. And that's when he started, like a fool, trying to beat me up. Roger badly beat Keith up, knocking him out. When Keith was revived, they had to go on and do their second show of the evening, which was understandably tense. On their return to England, the other three insisted that Roger be thrown out of the group. He was thrown out really for interfering with our lifestyles, remembers Pete. Keith, John, and I really liked drugs, and he didn't. But Roger didn't leave the band straight away. We had commitments, Roger said later, so we decided to promote My Generation and see if we could get a hit, and then leave while it was at the top, which I agreed to. I was a bastard up until then, but I had to be with that lot, because before we had roadies, I used to get the gear together, get them out of bed to get them to gigs, set up the gear, and there's no way you could have treated them any other way, because they were... Townsend was horrible. It's great, you know, Moon being a funny man when you're really rich and can afford it. But then, if we were going to get anywhere, we still had lots of responsibilities. So there you have it. Some justification to Rogers. We've only got time for one more, so I'm going to play the song that ends the British album. It appears on the American album, too, as a second-to-last track. It's a crazy live jam entitled The Ox. Oh, and by the way, if you're wondering what all this piano is all over this record, because who doesn't have a piano player? That's Nicky Hopkins playing piano. Nicky Hopkins, who played with everybody in England at the time, really. He even gets writing credit on this song. It's credited to Townsend, Moon, Entwistle, and Hopkins. Not Daltrey, because there's no vocals. Take care, everybody. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week. We'll be right back.
This show is brought to you by the NYCB Theater at Westbury, who presents Paul Anka.